time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. In early 1967, a guy working in cargo operations for Air France at New York's John F. Kennedy Airport tipped off a few of his friends about how they could all make a little money. Seemed that every week, Air France carried linen sacks of cash from Southeast Asia back to the United States for deposit. Each sack usually contained $60,000, and if you did the math on how many linen bags and how much each contained, you knew that the airline was hauling something like $1 million a week through JFK, one way into Queens. The employee, Robert Frenchie McMahon, knew exactly where the money went. It was stashed inside the same large warehouse where travelers came to retrieve their lost luggage. The sacks of cash were not especially locked away. They were placed in a cement storage room and always guarded by a single guy. And that guy had the key to open the otherwise badly secured vault. It didn't take a genius to discover that one of the solo guards was easily distracted by a certain type of woman. A plan was drawn up to simply have McMahon, the insider, arrange a meet between the guard and a willing escort where they could, you know, get acquainted. On April 7th, 1967, McMahon and three accomplices arrange for the woman to show up at the guard's meal break and offer him some together time at a nearby motel. This way, McMahon and co. could steal his pants, from which dangled the key to the vault. Timing was everything. They had to take the pants and have the key quickly duplicated by a nearby locksmith. It worked. They returned the pants, the guard none the wiser. Soon after, two of the men strolled into the Air France terminal posing as travelers looking for lost bags. They carried empty suitcases. With the freshly made key, they opened the storage room, grabbed 7 linen sacks, loaded up, and walked out unchallenged. The take was $420,000. The robbers included a small-time gangster wannabe named Henry Hill and a violent mob protege named Tommy D. Simone. The heist was not supposed to be a dress rehearsal for anything, just a good way to impress New York's wise guy bosses and pocket some considerable cash. But the Air France robbery was assigned to some that JFK Airport was a veritable Fort Knox, albeit one that was badly guarded. Money was there for the taking. Still, if you planned smart and executed well, nobody would get hurt. What could go wrong? Well, as it turned out, plenty. The Air France job proved that with the right mix of inside knowledge, distraction, and timing, the supposedly secure world of airport cargo could be cracked wide open. It wasn't just about the cash in those seven linen bags. It was about what the score represented, a model for future heists that would grow larger, riskier, and deadlier, drawing in some of the most dangerous men in New York's underworld. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Rula. You know what still surprises me?
What's that?
How hard it is to find a therapist who actually takes your insurance. A friend of mine has been looking 4 months, and the options are either out-of-pocket sticker shock or a months-long wait list.
Which, when you're stressed, is the last thing you need.
Right? That's why I told her to check out Rula. They make it easy to connect with a licensed therapist who actually works with your insurance. Most people pay around $15 a session, sometimes even zero, depending on your plan.
And it's not just about cost. Rula has a network of over 15,000 therapists and psychiatrists nationwide. So you're not just matched with whoever's available, you actually get a choice that fits your needs.
They also stick with you through the process. Rula checks in, makes sure your care is working, and helps you move forward. That's the kind of support that makes all the difference.
Thousands have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. Head over to Rula.com/COTC to get started today.
And after you sign up, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. That's RULA.com/COTC and take the first step toward better mental health today. You deserve quality care from someone who cares. It's not like the crime families in New York didn't know that JFK was a cash cow. They did. $30 billion worth of goods passed through the airport a year, and that was what was officially reported. Since the day Idlewild Airport, as it was originally known, opened in 1948, area mobsters had regularly hijacked all kinds of cargo, offloading packed trucks into their own vehicles. Cigarettes, designer clothes, electronics, liquor. If it could be moved, it could be stolen. Truckers who got hijacked were usually well compensated for being absent when the unloading took place. Most of this was courtesy of the Lucchese family, which ruled Queens, where the airport was located. Crews from the Gambino family had also staked out a slice of the JFK pie, leading to occasional complications with the Lucchese crowd, but such was life. The Genoveses, Columbos, and Bonanos, New York's equally dangerous families, might infrequently partake, but usually only with prior permission from the Lucchese or Gambino capos. I bring this up because the world these gangsters lived in was ruthless, violent in the extreme, and bound by strict rules. The codes they lived by would be the making and unmaking of many people. In those days, keeping your mouth shut, omerta, was often the line between who got rich and who got killed. Maybe still, I don't know. But this crime of the century was a mob job, something law enforcement instinctively knew the minute they answered the phone on an early morning in 1978 when a Lufthansa cargo worker called to say they'd been robbed. The cops knew it smelled a lot like Air France, circa 1967. They quickly knew the name of the man who had put the crew together. What they didn't know could have filled an airport hangar. It all started, more or less, with Peter Grunewald, a worker at the Lufthansa cargo facility on the very outskirts of JFK. A man with no criminal record, Grunewald saw the money and jewelry that came in regularly from Europe bound for the high-value storage vault in the facility. He had also seen that, while, yes, security at the cargo holds at the airport had been tightened since the Air France debacle, it wasn't foolproof by any means. Grunewald had been mulling over a way to grab a single night's haul, which he figured could be worth $1 million on a good day. But he didn't have the muscle to make it happen. So he looked around the warehouse for someone who not only needed money, but had connections to people who could pull it off. Here's Grunewald talking to the History Channel.
I heard from guys at work, Louis had liked the gamble, and he was into some money to the mob.
In fact, Louis Werner was on the hook for $20,000, but not to the mob. He owed it to a bookie named Marty Krugman. When Grunewald told Werner about his big scheme, Werner was all in. They spent some time perfecting the plan together. Soon enough, though, and without Grunewald's knowledge, Werner broached the topic of the big stick-up to Krugman, who absolutely wanted his $20,000 back plus 10% of the take. Krugman, who was German and Jewish, didn't have much real contact with the Italian or Irish families running JFK's rackets, but he knew someone who did, Henry Hill. Hill was a favorite of the Lucchese capo, Jimmy the Gent Burke. Krugman suggested Burke put the crew together and manage the heist for maximum profit. Hill's job was to sell Burke on the idea. Now, let me disabuse you of any notion that the Gent, despite the nickname, was any sort of kindly mob boss. Here's Henry Hill speaking decades later to the British documentary series Real Crime about Burke. Please be advised that the language he uses here is rough and may be offensive to some, included not just because of the information he imparts, but as an indication of the milieu in which Hill and Burke worked.
No one fucked with Jimmy Burke because he was the most fucking vicious motherfucker you ever met in your life. Yeah, you know, he'd pat you on the fucking back and in the hand stick a fucking ice pick in your head.
You can see why this case would eventually draw Martin Scorsese's attention, but more on that later. Born into a poor family, Burke was placed in an orphanage at age 2. He grew up fighting for every morsel and doing whatever it took to gain an edge. The mob life beckoned. As a young adult, he grew in stature in the Lucchese family after he endured savage beatings and prison, never once ratting out those he worked for. As a reward for that, when he got out, he was given the title to Robert's Lounge, a dingy, run-down, after-hours working-class bar that sat at the edge of the borough. New York International Airport, a.k.a. Idlewild, a.k.a. JFK, wasn't far away. Robert's Lounge became the planning hub for the Lufthansa heist, as well as countless other hijackings, robberies, blackmailings, shootings, and killings over the years. It was common knowledge that several bodies were buried in its basement under the bocce court. And the swamp that lay just beyond JFK in those days was known as the funeral parlor, as it became a dumping ground for the dead that Jimmy couldn't fit in his underground hidey hole. So yeah, Burke was feared. But he could also be generous, smart, and loyal. The men above him in the family, and there were just a handful who were higher, respected him, his judgment, and his choices. T.J. English, author of Paddywhacked, The Untold Story of the Irish-American Gangster, explained,
"And the reason they liked working with him is he was an earner. The thing that distinguished Jimmy Burke was his ability to generate income. He was always scheming and thinking about criminal scams that he could pull off from the low level to the grandiose. Well, Jimmy Burke had a real talent for paying off whoever needed to be paid off. He knew how to grease the wheel so that it would make it easier for him to pull off whatever scam it was he had in mind."
So it was that Hill took Krugman to meet Jimmy the Gent. At first, Burke was cool to the idea, but knowing there was serious money to be had, he sent one of his guys, Joe Buddha Manry, to check out Werner. They met at the airport diner, where Werner filled in the blanks about the heist. The target was the high-value storage unit at the Lufthansa cargo facility, and the haul was estimated to be around, well, $2 million. That's in both cash and jewelry. According to The Lufthansa Heist, written by Henry Hill and Daniel Simone, Werner withheld a lot of details from Manry for fear the men he was talking to might cut him out. But he did say the caper had to take place on a Monday at 10 minutes shy of 3 in the morning. Manry passed the details on to Burke, who liked the setup. He had to get the okay from Lucchese capo Paul Vario, who would be on the hook for the prep costs but would see a serious dividend if the heist was successful. It was on. Burke assembled his crew, which included Werner, Manry, dumb but dutiful Angelo Seppi, psychopathic Tommy DeSimone, mob soldiers Joseph Costa, Louis Cafora, and Paolo Licastri, and the tragically stupid Parnell Stax Edwards. Licastri was a late addition, as Burke had to get an A-OK for the big score from the Gambino family via special arrangement with John Gotti. Gotti inserted Licastri to protect his interests. Burke agreed and made sure Gotti would get a cut. It made for strange bedfellows, but for the anticipated $2 million theft, about $9.5 million in today's money, enemies could make nice. Burke studied the layout of the crime and the timing. He briefed his minions separately so that no one knew everything, forcing them to act as a team to succeed. He cautioned heavily against unnecessary violence. The guards they'd have to wrangle and handcuff were just working stiffs. This wasn't their money being stolen. There was no reason for anyone to die over Lufthansa's loss. Burke insisted that all communication be done in person, preferably at Robert's Lounge. No phone calls. He was sure that other mafiosos or the feds were listening in. He briefed each of the men on the roles individually. He rehearsed them both one-on-one and as a team. He knew this was an operation that would require timing and immediacy. He wanted no one to be recognized or traced in any way. They'd wear masks and gloves, no faces, no fingerprints. There was to be no talking among themselves during the robbery, no calling out of each other's names, no way for anyone to detect an accent. He even assigned a spokesperson, the one among them who had the least queens in his mouth, to do the talking. He wanted to offer up no clues as to who the police should start looking at. The money arrangements became complicated, who got what percentage, but the gent was keeping tabs. He'd handle the money. All of this was made only marginally more difficult by the fact that Burke had been operating out of a prison cell. Arrangements, you know, could be made if the right palms were greased. In fact, he and DeSimone were released to a halfway house just a month before the heist was scheduled, after having served most of their 10-year sentences in federal prison for extortion. Now, I say the heist planning was only marginally hampered because both Burke and DeSimone had been placed in the New York Community Treatment Center, where they were allowed to leave during the day to work, were unmonitored while they were gone, and asked to return by 11 p.m. to be locked back up for the night. Work was a loosely defined concept, I'm guessing, but Burke owned a bar and it had to be run, and that was excuse enough. DeSimone could find any number of shop owners who would be happy to say he worked there. On the night of December 10th, 1978, Burke and DeSimone made quite the fuss on returning to the halfway house for the night, providing something memorable so the guards there could easily recall if asked about the two men's alibis. But honestly, everyone housed at the treatment center knew there was an easy way out. Just wait until after the 11 p.m. count. Then, as per Hill and Simone's retelling, quote, "If a convict wished to stroll down 42nd Street or rendezvous with a hot date or rob an airline, he could do so at his whim." Sneaking out was simple, through a window, onto the fire escape, and into the alley. As long as you return by the same route no later than 7 a.m. when the inmates were checked out, no one would be the wiser, end quote. That night, like a lot of nights, they had a car waiting for them a block away. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Cornbread Hemp. The college class I'm teaching is well underway now, and between that, Scott's work, and H's school schedule, life is busy.
It really is.
By the end of the day, I need real help winding down.
Which is why you've been reaching for Cornbread Hemp CBD gummies.
Yep, I've been taking the berry-flavored sleep gummies, and honestly, they're the best part of my bedtime routine. Forget counting sheep. These are way tastier and way more effective.
Cornbread Hemp makes their CBD gummies from the flower only. No stems, no seeds, for the purest, most potent CBD. And they're third-party lab-tested and USDA organic, so you know they're clean.
Clean, and more importantly, they work. Otherwise, I'd still be lying awake at 2 a.m. debating if I should email my students another reminder about their deadlines.
Which nobody wants.
Exactly. Right now, Crimes of the Century's listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/COTC and use code COTC at checkout.
That's cornbreadhemp.com/COTC. Use code COTC.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The freshly stolen black Ford van arrived at JFK's Building 261, the Lufthansa cargo facility, loaded with a half dozen men at about 2:45 on the morning of December 11, 1978. They parked conveniently near a padlocked gate. A few were already masked. Shipping clerk Carrie Whelan, who was right on time bringing back air bills from other airlines, was startled to see the van, telling the driver straight away he couldn't park there. That's when the gangster instincts of Angelo Seppi kicked in. Unmasked, he jumped out of the van and hit Whelan hard on the head with the butt of his semi-automatic weapon, then threw him into a headlock. Whelan's wound was deep, gushing blood down his face and onto Seppi. Joe Manry joined in, ramming his shotgun into Whelan's stomach when the clerk tried to scream for help. Whelan would not forget the face of the man who hammered steel into his head and who restrained him while the other guy pounded him in the stomach, even as yet another guy asked him for the three-sided key that would let them through the gates to the terminal. Even dazed, Whelan still had the wherewithal to realize that was some mighty specific information they had. In quick practice sequence, the crew used bolt cutters, then the key, to successfully bypass any initial alarms. Once in, the thieves subdued another clerk and headed for the lone watchman in front of the high-value vault. They knew he'd be elderly and not likely to give them any trouble. He tried to fight a little, at least verbally, but he quickly folded when told people would be hurt or killed if he didn't cooperate. Louis Werner had been as good as his word. Things were going like clockwork. Manry's job was to find the 7 employees who were supposed to be in the lunchroom for their 3 a.m. break. He had already corralled 2 of them, then found another in the hallway as he, Tommy DeSimone, and Louis Cafora moved toward the cafeteria. Manry also needed to find the supervisor, the one with the important keys to the inner safe inside the vault. As planned, Seppi and Lacastri had been left on the vault floor in case anyone else showed up. Before the group split up, both Seppi and Lacastri offered to personally kill anyone that Manry felt needed killing. Adrenaline was running high, I guess. When Manry, his cohorts, and their hostages, including the still-bleeding Whelan, reached the cafeteria, the 4 employees inside looked up from their lunches. For a second, they thought it was a joke, a macabre prank staged by coworkers. Guns waved, voices barked orders, blood dripped from a head wound. Then the shouting turned sharper, and the muzzles pointed directly at them. The joke was over. As former coworker Peter Grunewald told the History Channel,
"For some of the guys, it might have been the most terrifying night of their life."
The men hit the floor on command. They were cuffed, their wallets taken, a detail Burke had insisted on. Now the robbers had each man's driver's license, his home address, his family's location. The implication was then verbalized: "Talk and we'll kill your families." The only one missing now was Rudy Eirich, the supervisor with the inner vault key. This was not unexpected. Grunewald again.
Rudy didn't leave his office, no matter what. So they made the office senior agent call Rudy on the phone and told him he had to come up to the office and talk to them. And he called down to Rudy on the office phone that he had a call from Germany and they wanted to talk to the supervisor. And it worked.
Soon, everyone was assembled in the cafeteria where Eirich, rather bravely, told the armed intruders that they needed to call an ambulance for Whelan. Manry said maybe after he had helped them get the big money and the nice jewelry out of the high-value vault. With that, Manry, Frenchie McMahon, and Eirich went downstairs to disable the alarms, something that required the right sequence and timing. You had to fully close the first door before attempting to unlock the second, or the Port Authority cops would know there was trouble. Manry assured Eirich that if he did what he was told to do and he didn't try to be a hero, they'd all live to see another day. Eirich complied. He pointed out every safeguard, every alarm, all of which he was surprised to realize the robbers already seemed to know about. It struck him that these guys probably had had help from inside the building. It had to be Lewis Werner. It all moved as planned. The boxes were there, 50 of them, full of $100 bills. The cargo door opened to let in the black van, which backed up to the vault for an easy transfer of 300 pounds of plunder, straight from Lufthansa's hands into theirs. That done, Manry headed upstairs to gather up his comrades and issue his final orders to the handcuffed men. Tommy DeSimone, anxious to know if they'd all gotten rich while he was watching the cafeteria crowd, pulled off his mask to wipe his sweaty face and asked, "Did you find what we came for?" Manry angrily told him to lower his mask, but it was too late. Two of the Lufthansa clerks, Rolf Redman and John Murray, had seen his face. Manry then told them they had to wait 20 minutes before calling 911, precisely the time the robbers had calculated they needed to clear the airport. It was about 3:45 a.m. The practice had paid off. The crew headed downstairs, driving the speed limit to a warehouse, a safe house gift from John Gotti, where Burke was waiting. There, the cartons of money were moved into the trunk of a white Toyota Corona and covered with 12 pounds of rotting fish. It was an old smuggler's trick. No cop would want to dig through that. Burke then told his guys that they'd see their money in 5 days. When they got paid, he warned, nobody was to spend big and call attention to their newfound wealth. Parnell Stacks Edwards, a freelancer, a good friend of Henry Hill and the only black man involved in the crime, was given the job of getting the Ford van to a demolition firm to be crushed into a tight steel cube before the cops even knew it existed. Burke and his son Frank then drove the Toyota to Gaspar Gary Valenti's house and dumped the cartons into a recently dug trench inside the garage. The gent then was let off near the halfway house to reverse his steps and crawl back into bed to be counted again at 7 a.m. Here's NBC's national news anchor, John Chancellor.
There was a holdup of historic proportions at New York City's Kennedy Airport this morning. Several million dollars in cash and jewelry taken from a cargo hangar by a band of...
So far, the whole caper had gone according to plan, but that was about to change. Seems that Stacks had a woman problem and a cocaine problem and a priority establishing problem. He knew he had to get the van to the junkyard by daylight because around 6 a.m., a demolition yard worker was already waiting for him so the job could be quick and easy. Midway there, Stacks decided to take a pit stop. Special Agent Edmundo Guevara.
Stacks went over his girlfriend's house, got drunk and did some drugs, and he left the van on the streets for 2 days. The FBI got its first break when the New York City Police Department called in the plates of a van that was illegally parked.
I mean, seriously, the guy didn't just fail to destroy the van, but he parked it next to a fire hydrant in a bad part of Brooklyn.
A few days later, New York City PD connected the van to Stack Edwards. I'm sure when Jimmy Burke heard about Stacks and his failure to get rid of the van, that he was livid.
Inside the stolen van, they discovered the driver's license of Rudy Irick and credentials showing he worked for the JFK's Lufthansa cargo terminal, plus Stax's fingerprints. By then, the NYPD, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and the Port Authority Police were all involved. So too, the borough prosecutor. There were already murmurs about Jimmy Burke's possible involvement. For the feds, though, Louis Werner was the first man in their sights. Seems that 2 years earlier, on October 8, 1976, Werner had been suspected of a small-time cargo theft that investigators couldn't prove. His job at the time was to meet all incoming Lufthansa flights and remove any cargo shipments marked valuable on the manifest. Werner told investigators that after picking up a bag from Flight 493, he was suddenly struck with stomach trouble. He claimed he left the bag on the tarmac, that baggage handlers brought it back to him, and that when he opened it, $22,000 was gone. There was no hard proof of theft, but the story had been duly noted in the official files. A small aside, Werner had indeed stolen the money, according to Peter Grunewald, who said he himself had helped hide it. By now, Grunewald knew that Werner had taken their, correction, his, original plan and sold it to a bunch of mobsters and left him, the guy who had dreamed up the heist in the first place, out in the cold with no cut of the take. Brings to mind that old saying about honor among thieves. As it stood, at least publicly, the Lufthansa take looked to be worth something like $2.5 million. Grunewald wasted no time in confronting Werner, who offered him a measly $8,000 to smooth things over. Grunewald lost his temper. Werner got the message. He promised to make it right. Meanwhile, the various cop agencies involved were arguing over jurisdiction and getting nowhere on the case. They all had been disappointed to learn that none of the bills had been marked. It wasn't like cops didn't have a hunch. They questioned Werner's and Grunewald's comrades repeatedly. Investigators also questioned everyone connected to the cargo terminal. Redman and Whelan worked with forensic artists to create sketches of the men whose faces they had seen. Shown mugshots, Redman ultimately identified Tommy DeSimone. Whelan was able to ID Angelo Seppi as the guy who bashed in his skull. That meant only one thing to FBI supervising special agent Stephen Carboni. This was absolutely the work of the guys who operated out of Robert's Lounge. Both Whelan and Redman were happy to help, up to a point. They were not willing, they told the FBI, to testify in open court. They had been warned. Meanwhile, Lufthansa accountants kept revising their loss, which finally ended up being something like $5 million in cash and another mill in jewelry. If you wanted to spend that today, you'd have about $28 million at your disposal. Even split more than a few ways, it was a good payday. The theft was, as newspapers and newscasters at the time repeated often, the largest of its kind ever pulled off in the United States to date. The FBI was feeling the pressure to make some headway. Then, Parnell Stax Edwards, whose fingerprints were all over the black Ford van, was found dead with five 25 caliber bullets to the back of his head. Tommy DeSimone, Stax's best friend, had done the job at the request of Jimmy the Gent. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Home Chef. You know what, Scott?
What's that?
Summer's over.
I know. It flew by way too fast.
And now that it's over, we're back to the nightly What's for Dinner grind, and I miss those carefree summer nights already.
Same here. That's why we're leaning on Home Chef. They deliver fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes right to our door, so dinner actually feels easy.
And it's not just easy, it's good. Home Chef has over 30 options every week, from classic meal kits to 30-minute recipes, oven-ready options, microwave meals, even a family menu.
I'm a fan of the new 5-ingredient meals. Just 5 fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and dinner's done. It's my kind of man.
Plus, it's economical. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 a month on groceries, which is way better than blowing the budget on takeout every night.
And users of leading meal kits have rated Home Chef number one in quality, convenience, value, taste, and recipe ease.
For a limited time, Home Chef is offering my listeners 50% off and free shipping on your first box, plus free dessert for life. Go to homechef.com/COTC.
That's homechef.com/COTC for 50% off your first box and free dessert for life.
Homechef.com/COTC. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Frightened by news of Stack's execution and after being contacted by FBI agents, Louis Cafora and his wife decided maybe they should tell what they knew. A confidential FBI informant had given agents Cafora's name, and they had just been following up when the Caforas had a break-in at home. They woke up to see three men in their garage. Lou and his wife assumed it was their mafia associates planning a car bomb in their Cadillac. They decided together to talk with the FBI, setting up an appointment with Special Agent Edmundo Guevara, who was assigned to the Lufthansa case. The Caforas didn't show for the appointment, or anywhere else, until a month later, when children playing under a bridge found their decomposing bodies still seated in the Cadillac, both with bullet wounds to the head. 2 months after the big score, the FBI subpoenaed Peter Grunewald. When deposed, he said he knew nothing about the whole business. He left their offices, sure he cleared the bar. Then he boarded a plane for a pre-planned vacation and was promptly accosted by Special Agent Guevara. Told he was suspected of fleeing the country, Grunewald was read his rights in his economy class seat and hauled to the Nassau County Jail, a miserable place by any standard, to think things over. 3 days later, Grunewald cracked. He gave a 2-hour statement to the FBI and the U.S. attorney, naming names, including Frank Mena, a go-between when Werner and Manry were assembling the crew early on. The FBI already knew Mena's name from previous cases linking him to Burke. He also worked as a runner for Marty Krugman's bookmaking business. Stephen Carboni, the FBI's supervising agent in charge, told Guevara to put Krugman next on their list of men to talk to. Maybe now they were getting somewhere. Then, out of the blue, Louis Werner's wife, Beverly, called the feds to say her husband had told her, in so many words, that he was in on the Lufthansa job. Back at Robert's lounge, Krugman had been grumbling loudly to anyone who would listen that he wanted his money from the heist. Krugman felt he was owed more, given that he had received a percentage of the haul, and now the airline had estimated the take to be $6 million, not $2 million. He badgered Burke, which, as you can guess, did not go over well. A few days later, Krugman went missing. According to Crime Library, Henry Hill later said he had initially found it hard to fathom. Then it dawned. Hill said, quote, "Now I know why Jimmy wanted to whack Marty. It's a matter of $500,000. No way Jimmy was going to deny himself $500,000 because Marty Krugman. If Jimmy killed Marty, Jimmy would get Marty's $500,000, end quote. The next domino to fall per law enforcement came when the FBI arrested Lou Werner and Angelo Seppi for the heist. The feds had bugged Tommy DeSimone's car, but got nothing. He kept the radio so loud that no conversations could be made out. Same problem with the car Angelo Seppi drove. Still, law enforcement was certain DeSimone was involved in the robbery. What they didn't know was that he had also whacked Stax Edwards. They were simply watching and listening, waiting for some loose talk that might help them unravel the whole mess. DeSimone was known for loose talk and for not being too bright. Burke worried about Seppi, but managed to get him released from custody quickly. No charges were ever filed. Burke relaxed, but only a little. The Edwards killing had shown DeSimone to be loyal to the team, gutsy, and willing to follow hard directions. So maybe it wasn't too big of a surprise when he was told that he was to receive the Mafia's greatest honor. He was now to be christened a made man. That is, virtually untouchable in the mob world. There was even a big dinner planned for the occasion, an anointment of sorts by the Lucchese family. For DeSimone, this was good news. It meant he was officially recognized and decidedly safer than he was before. According to some stories, DeSimone walked into the gala event being held at a quiet Italian restaurant where a lot of his friends were assembled. He was surprised to see Gambino Capo, John Gotti in attendance, but was led to an empty chair at the center of the room. Gotti rose, walked to DeSimone, and shot him 3 times in the back of the head. Gotti had asked permission to do this from Lucchese Don Paul Vario, so no one blinked. It was, many said, revenge for a past transgression against the Gambino family. And because the Lucchese family had its own reasons, Jimmy Burke fearing that DeSimone might spill the beans about who the mastermind of Lufthansa was, they had no problem with Gotti doing some all-purpose cleanup. And so it went. This is FBI Special Agent Guevara.
Every time I went out to talk to one of Jimmy Burke's associates that was involved in the robbery, it seemed that they would end up dead.
The official death tally of those involved in the heist would turn out to be 12. Co-conspirator Gary Valenti, they used his garage as the first hiding place for the loot, disputes that number.
I would say approximately between 20 and 30 people got killed, massacred. Not killed, I would say massacred more or less.
The list included Stax, Krugman, the Caforas, Seppi, and Seppi's girlfriend, Teresa Ferrara, a hairdresser who slept with Paul Vario but got spooked and began talking to the FBI. After that, graves were dug for Frenchie McMahon and Joe Manry, both of whom had whined to Burke that they had actually done the robbery, but everybody else's take was so much bigger than theirs. Paolo Lacastri was killed a few months later after he insulted the uncle of his ex-girlfriend. When Seppi died, the New York Times story about his murder noted that the government had arrested him for his involvement in the $6 million robbery. Edward McDonald, the federal prosecutor in charge of the Eastern District's Organized Crime Strike Force, told the paper that though they'd arrested Seppi, they hadn't been able to indict him because, quote, so many people involved in the robbery who had information we needed were killed, end quote. That whole adage, you live by the sword, you die by it, was certainly true in this case. But the killings were fueled by paranoia and greed, some of it tied to the quick arrest, indictment, and conviction of Louis Werner. The New York Post noted that his May 1979 trial included more journalists than spectators. In a nutshell, Werner had told his mistress and his wife that he'd robbed his employer of a great deal of money. He was protected against his wife testifying, but his mistress was another matter. She spoke up and the feds charged Werner under the Hobbs Act, which makes it a federal crime to steal from interstate or international commerce. Under the law, it didn't matter if you were present during the theft, planning it was enough. Werner could have talked and made a deal, but he didn't, something that surprised prosecutors. Instead, he was convicted on 6 charges. Then he decided to help prosecutors out, meaning that his 15-year sentence was reduced to 5, and after serving, he married the girlfriend who sent him there and disappeared, courtesy of the Federal Witness Protection Program. It's assumed that Werner's knowledge was the thing that kept Jimmy the Gent Burke awake at night and kept his assassins busy. It was the thing he had most feared. Witnesses. Men who knew where the bodies were buried.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Some of you must be thinking just about now, haven't I seen this movie? Probably. Henry Hill's rise and fall as a mob-connected bad guy and his involvement, such as it was, in the Lufthansa heist are the basis for the six-time Oscar-nominated 1990 Martin Scorsese film that many call his masterpiece, Goodfellas. Hill's story reached Scorsese not because the former mobster went Hollywood, but because of journalist Nicholas Pileggi. Pileggi had spent years interviewing Hill for his 1985 book Wise Guy, which chronicled Hill's life in the mob and his cooperation with the government. Scorsese read an advance copy, called Pileggi, and told him, "I've been waiting for this book my entire life." The two teamed up to adapt it into Goodfellas, with Hill's account, sometimes embellished, sometimes self-serving, providing the raw material for one of cinema's most influential crime dramas. What's funny, maybe, is that while Hill was instrumental in the Air France heist a few years before the Lufthansa hit, he had almost zero involvement in the latter. He was, at best, a middleman broker, a guy who introduced people to one another and then got out of the way. It wasn't until 1980, when he was facing substantial prison time for narcotics trafficking, that he made a deal based on all his knowledge of the cargo terminal holdup. Today, experts point to Hill's testimony as the beginning of the end for the mobster era, where families of criminals controlled big cities like New York, Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, and Vegas. And not to put too fine a point on it, but Henry Hill proved that you could rat them out and live. Maybe it had just gotten too violent, too unseemly, too public. Truth was, Henry Hill was no hero. He was a cocaine and heroin addict, a serial philanderer, and a major drug trafficker. And from his interviews, he seemed proud of all of it. He swore until his dying day that he never killed anyone. But as Simon Whistler of the YouTube channel Biographics said, quote, "he surely got some killed," end quote. That doesn't speak well of Hill, but it doesn't mean he was a stupid man. Whistler.
Hill couldn't help but notice that all the people around him were dropping like flies. He was realistic. He understood that under the right circumstances, all of his past history with guys like Burke or Paul Vario would mean little. They would bump him off in a heartbeat in order to protect themselves.
Which is why he turned state's evidence and testified about the Lufthansa robbery and the trail of murders that followed. His testimony helped secure about 50 convictions of top-level mob figures. It also, in a separate matter, helped to convict Jimmy Burke of murdering Richard Eaton, ostensibly his partner in Robert's Lounge, Eaton held the liquor license, for misusing money that Burke had given him to invest. For his cooperation, Hill was placed in the Federal Witness Protection Program, where he lived for more than a decade. At one point, by the way, he lived in Northern Kentucky and worked giving tours of Cincinnati's Union Terminal. Once he was even quoted and pictured as his alias in the Cincinnati Enquirer. FBI didn't like that. Hill and his family were safe, but they had to move frequently and always look over their shoulders. But Hill was not a man fit for going straight. He was ousted from witness protection in the early 1990s, not for cooperating with a journalist on a book that used his real name, but because he had been arrested on drug charges. He got divorced from his long-suffering wife, Karen, and decided most of the people who might want him dead were either in prison or in the ground. Hill then went back to using his real name full time. By then, Goodfellas had been a cultural phenomenon. When it hit theaters in 1990, it wasn't just another mob movie. It redefined the genre. Martin Scorsese's frenetic pacing, freeze-frame narration, and meticulous eye for the mob's everyday rituals pulled audiences into a world that felt both glamorous and suffocating. The Lufthansa heist sequence, with its swaggering Ray Liotta voiceover and score of all scores bravado, cemented the robbery and pop culture far more than news coverage ever had. For a generation that hadn't followed the headlines in 1978, Goodfellas became the story of Lufthansa. Henry Hill, its unreliable narrator. The film was successful, earning 6 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, and 1 win for Joe Pesci, who played Tommy DeVito, a fictionalized version of Tommy DeSimone.
What's really funny is the fucking bank job away in Sea Caucus, I'm in the middle of the fucking weeds, laying down. He comes over, he says, what are you doing? I said, I'm resting. Here you're resting on a fucking beach in a park. I said, I'm resting.
For what it's worth, associates of the real Tommy say he was far scarier than Pesci made him seem. And a lot bigger, too. He was about 6'3" and was nicknamed Tommy Two Guns because he always had 2 pistols on him.
I said, all right, I'll tell you something. Go fuck your mother.
Anyway, the movie turned Hill into a minor celebrity and helped keep the heist alive in the public imagination. Today, the movie is still cited on greatest films lists, its dialogue quoted, its scenes dissected, and its version of events often accepted as fact, even when the truth was murkier. After Goodfellas, Hill was apparently quite pleased with himself and his life. He wrote several books. He died a surprisingly natural death for someone with his background, succumbing in 2012 to heart disease. The money and valuables from the Lufthansa heist were never recovered. But the story doesn't end there. In January 2014, a New York grand jury indicted 79-year-old Vincent DeSaro for his alleged participation in the $6 million robbery that had taken place 36 years earlier. He was, rather astonishingly, only the second person ever charged for the crime. Specifically, the charges were 1 count of racketeering and 2 counts of extortion. Probably more a sign of the frustration of the FBI and New York prosecutors in their inability to pin the rap on anyone who was still breathing, the indictment served as a fresh reminder of the audacity and the scale of the 1978 robbery. DeSaro, who had grown from a small-time operative in 78 to a Bonanno family capo, had apparently told his cousin, Gaspar Valenti, that he was still bitter over not getting the right money, what we were supposed to get. Valenti, by then a police informant, had no qualms about turning DeSaro in. Here's Scott Rappaport reporting on October 14th, 2015, the first day of the trial for the CBS affiliate in New York. The laughter at the start is because he was segueing out of a scene from Goodfellas.
Prosecutors say DeSaro was part of the Bonanno family crime crew that robbed the Lufthansa cargo facility at Kennedy Airport in 1978, netting $5 million in cash and nearly $1 million in jewels. They say DeSaro's take was more than $500,000 and called it the score of all scores. Quote, the defendant is a gangster through and through. He lived and breathed the mafia. The defense saying, the government's cooperating witnesses are a bunch of liars and cheaters.
He didn't do it, had nothing to do with it.
After hearing from 70 witnesses, DeSaro was acquitted on November 11th, 2015 of all charges. But he wasn't out of danger. At the time, he was already awaiting trial for the 1969 murder of Paul Katz, a killing prosecutors alleged he committed with Jimmy Burke, strangling Katz with a dog chain. DeSaro's son, Jerome, had already been found guilty of disposing Katz's body. According to the New York Daily News, Katz's daughter, Isla, brought her father's ashes to Jerome DeSaro's sentencing, hoping the jury would understand her grief. Katz had been found buried under the bocce court. Do To research this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read The Lufthansa Heist, Behind the $6 Million Cash Haul That Shook the World by Henry Hill and Daniel Simone. She read a lot of Jimmy Breslin in the New York Post, the CrimeLibrary.org series of articles on the robbery, and the New York Times and New York Newsday's coverage of the Vincent Tesoro trial. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grab Bag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt fan Ben Skoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.
Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialistly. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialistly with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.